Tonight and also next week, our subject is Monopoly. And I want to start off introducing an important concept of Monopoly, which is not often discussed. And we'll spend some portion of tonight on that. And then most of our discussion will be of the better known concept. There are two concepts of Monopoly. One I call the political concept of Monopoly, the other the economic concept of Monopoly. And the reason for this terminology is the political concept, views Monopoly as a political problem in that it holds Monopoly is imposed on the economic system from without by political action, by government intervention. The far more common concept of monopoly, namely the economic concept, holds that monopoly is a natural, inevitable outgrowth of the economic system itself and requires political action to deal with it. So one holds that the problem is originates outside of the economic system, is imposed by the government. That's the political concept. The other holds that it originates within the economy and requires government action to deal with it. To lay some groundwork for the discussion, particularly of the political concept, we need to recall some aspects of our discussion of the concept of freedom early in the term. There are two fundamental conflicting views of the nature of freedom. One I refer to as the anarchic concept, which is the notion that freedom means you can do anything you like, anywhere, anytime you like, and anything that prevents you from realizing any desire you might have is to that extent a restriction, a limitation, a violation of your freedom. So on the anarchic view of freedom, if you felt like squaring circles or walking through walls or being at two places at the same time and the nature of reality stands in your way, that would be viewed as a violation of freedom. If you felt like violating the law of gravity, that would be held to be a violation of freedom. If you feel like murdering your mother-in-law and will likely spend the rest of your life in jail or be executed, and therefore that creates quite a barrier to doing it, well, that would be viewed as a violation of an alleged freedom to commit murder. Now, in contrast to that approach, there is what I've called the rational concept of freedom, which regards freedom as a concept resting on a fairly substantial underlying foundation, which first of all takes for granted the nature of reality, the laws of logic, the laws of mathematics, all of the laws of physical nature, and anything that you can't do because reality stands in the way, that's not a violation of freedom, that's just something you can't do. Not everything you can't do and might like to do is a violation of freedom. The fact that you will likely go to jail if you commit murder or mayhem, that's not a violation of your freedom. On the rational concept of freedom, we take for granted the laws of logic, the laws of nature, the facts of reality, and that insofar as you are to have the cooperation of other people, it has to be on a voluntary basis. So if here you are, there is something which is possible for you to do, you're prepared to accept the consequences, you have the voluntary cooperation of everyone involved, and the only thing that is stopping you from doing it is the initiation of force, in particular by the government, then your freedom is violated. So if there's something you can do, you wish to do, you have the voluntary cooperation of whoever may be involved, and what stops you from doing it is only the initiation of physical force, then and only then is your freedom violated. That's what I call the rational concept of freedom. to take some illustrations, in point two, I say the distinction applied, first of all, to censorship. All right, suppose I would like my views to appear in the New York Times, but anytime I send the Times an op-ed piece, I never hear from them. Is that a violation of my freedom of the press?
No.
Not on the rational concept. That's something I'm unable to do. I don't have the cooperation of the Times. They're not willing to spread my ideas. But that's not a violation of my freedom. Perhaps not being able to appear in the Times, or maybe anywhere for that matter, if all I am able to do is run something off my computer printer and maybe have some copies Xeroxed and mail them to people, if that's all that I can do in the circumstances confronting me, well, then that's all I can do. And the only thing that would violate my freedom would be if I were somehow physically stopped from doing that. Like if the government's post office refused to accept such anti-government mail, perhaps, if that was the issue. Now, where a violation of freedom of press would occur is suppose the Times wanted to publish me, or there is some newspaper that would. So here I have, I'm able to write something. I have a willing publisher who is prepared to publish it. And now if what stops me is the government says no, if the government says no, we do not allow it, that would be a violation of my freedom of press. If everything is capable of going and the thing that's preventing it is the government, and obviously it's initiating force if it does this, then you have a violation of freedom of press. Similarly, if I want to give a talk somewhere, if I show up at 2:30 in the morning in your bedroom to give you a lecture, and you pull out your shotgun and tell me to leave, that's not a violation of my freedom of speech. Pardon me? Okay, but if you invited me to your living room to address you and some friends, and then what stopped me from delivering my talk was that the police broke down the door because this was an illegal talk, that would be a violation of my freedom of speech. Now, the same ideas apply to such matters as the freedom of competition and the freedom and barriers to entry. Those who hold the anarchic concept of freedom believe that freedom of competition is violated any time and to whatever extent people are unable to compete. If there's anything that prevents someone from competing, they view that as an abridgment of the freedom of competition. So from that perspective, high capital requirements are an infringement on the freedom of competition. Suppose that in order to be in a business and compete, you need $1 billion of capital. If you don't have $1 billion of capital, you have no hope of being able to compete. Well, from the point of view of the anarchic concept of freedom, that's a violation of the freedom of competition. It's a barrier to entry and an infringement of the freedom of competition. Have you heard this point of view anywhere else? What do you think most textbooks say about barriers to entry? What's supposed to be a barrier to entry? That's a normal circumstance in a free market. Yeah? The capital requirements. So if you have an industry like the automobile industry, where in order to have an efficient sized factory, you might need at least $1 billion, maybe quite a bit more nowadays, and very few people have the necessary capital, that's considered an infringement on or a barrier to entry. That's called a barrier to entry and an infringement on the freedom of competition.
Can that be stretched to knowledge in the industry as well? Specialization?
It could also apply to knowledge. Suppose you just don't have the necessary specialized knowledge and you can't compete for that reason. Well, that would be called a barrier to entry. If only people in possession of a limited number of people are able to acquire this body of knowledge, that would also be regarded as a barrier to entry. Now, so these are in the categories of things you can't do for one reason or another. like, I can't buy a new Rolls-Royce automobile if I don't have at least $300,000 spare funds. Maybe it's more nowadays. And so there are people who would say, my freedom to buy a new automobile is violated. I have no freedom to buy a new automobile. I've ever heard people saying, what freedom is there to go to college if you can't afford the tuition? What freedom is there to buy a house if you can't afford to pay for it? Have you heard arguments along these lines? Well, on the perspective of the rational concept of freedom, none of these things is a violation of freedom. There are all kinds of things which, for one reason or another, we can't do, such as not have sufficient funds, but this does not represent any abridgment of our freedom. When would our freedom be violated in these circumstances? Well, yes, Ms. Fox?
If you are willing to pay, but the government stops you buying the property.
If you have the necessary funds, and what's stopping you is not the lack of funds, not the lack of knowledge, but the government, or someone resorting to force with the government's sanction. If the government, if there are private individuals who stop you by resorting to force and the government turns its back, doesn't investigate them, prosecute them, so it allows it to happen, then your freedom is violated. So your freedom of entry would be violated, not because you lack $1 billion. It would be violated in those cases in which, if you had $1 billion and could be in the market, and what stopped you was the government, then your freedom of entry, your freedom of competition would be violated. Now, cases of this kind are hardly ever considered. I don't think you'll find any discussion of them in the standard mainstream textbooks. So let's look at some real-world cases where you have violations of freedom of entry, freedom of competition, where there are firms that do have the necessary capital that would be in a position to compete, to enter a market or part of a market. But what stops them is some form of physical force. Can anyone think of such cases, real-world cases, where there are firms with the necessary capital, the necessary knowledge, they could be in markets or be in them to a greater extent than they are, but what's keeping them out is the government's initiation of force. Yes, Mr. Feldman.
Yeah, when Oracle was trying to buy PeopleSoft, technology, you have to get the government approval.
Okay, the Oracle trying to buy PeopleSoft, or more generally, perhaps.
FedEx trying to deliver first-class mail to the home.
All right, FedEx possibly trying to deliver first-class mail. I didn't know they were considering that, but any case where there is a merger that the firms are capable of consummating, that they are prepared to consummate on their own voluntary basis, and then the government steps in and says, no, the merger shall not proceed. Ms. Fox?
There's one going on right now. Anthem's trying to purchase WellPoint, but the insurance commissioners won't allow it because of the high bonuses that the senior management
will receive. Okay, you say there's an attempted merger of two health insurers. The insurance commissioner in California won't allow it for whatever reason. Now notice, when you have a merger, the firm that is the active firm seeking to expand, that's attempting to get into the market of the firm that it's acquiring. They could be in that market, they could be in that industry to a greater extent than they are, and they are prevented from doing so. They're kept out of a market or part of a market that they otherwise could be in. That is, in my judgment, a violation of their freedom of entry into that industry or that market segment, a violation of their freedom to compete in that market or market segment. Now, let me say a few words about the actual significance of high capital requirements. People who dismiss them as a barrier to entry, as though they're some kind of anti-competitive factor. You know, when people complain, well, it takes $1 billion or $2 billion, how many firms have such capital? And they say that's a limitation on competition. Well, let's consider for a moment, why does anyone need a large amount of capital? Why do you need $1 billion to be competitive in the automobile industry? Why can't you do it with $100 million? or 10 million.
Because they exchange for the money, for the capital.
Pardon me?
For example, to produce the automobile, it takes 4 or 5 years for the automakers to get the money, so they need 4 or 5 years, like some money to pay the labor's wage and all that.
All right, now you need capital, certainly there's this considerable waiting time, but why not have a firm that produces 100 cars a year and can wait for 5 years on 100 cars? That shouldn't take all that much money.
Can't keep your production costs competitive.
Your production costs would not be competitive. In order to achieve, in order to be able to sell profitably, in order to be profitable at the level of prices being charged by the firms that are already in the field, you would need to have costs significantly below the prevailing level of automobile prices. If you want to be profitable, you need sufficiently low costs that will give you some profit margin at today's level of automobile prices, at the prices being charged by other firms. Well, there's an important relationship between costs and economies of scale. If you're producing items in small quantities, you'll typically have a high unit cost. You have to achieve some substantial volume to bring your costs down to the point where they need to be. And you need large capital in order to produce on a sufficiently large scale, and to do so with a sufficient degree of mechanization, a sufficient degree of the use of efficient machinery and equipment. So the reason that you need $1 billion or whatever it is not as a barrier to competition, that is the result, that's the outcome of competitive conditions. Competition is what is requiring a capital of that size. And if you want to be competitive, that's the size capital you need. Now, what conditions would have to exist so that anyone with a capital of $1 million and up would be able to enter the automobile industry and be capable of competing?
If the prices are sufficient enough to produce.
Pardon me?
If the prices are sufficient enough to produce.
If we had a much higher level of automobile prices. See, if automobile prices were higher, then what does that do to the level of costs you can have and still make money? At higher prices, a higher cost can still make it possible for you to earn money. Well, the reason that you need all of this capital is because the competitive state of the market is requiring, has brought about a low level of prices, requiring that a profitable production achieve a low level of costs, a commensurately low level of costs. And in order to achieve such low costs, you need the high capital. The high capital is the means of achieving low costs. And if a firm that if the firms that have the large capital, suppose they decided, okay, here we are, there's only a small number of us, not very many people can enter the market with these huge capital requirements, so why don't we take advantage of our smallness of number and jack up the prices that we charge? Well, what happens if the present producers were to substantially raise their prices? What would they be doing to the size of the capital that potential new entrants would require? They'd be decreasing the required capital. They then be inviting additional competition. If they want to take advantage of their high capital and keep others out, the only way they can do so is by using the high capital to achieve low costs and to be profitable at prices too low for people to make money at with substantially lesser capital. The advantage of the high capital can only be realized if you're using it to achieve low costs and low enough prices to keep those who have less capital and therefore would have higher costs out of the field. This, I think, is the actual significance of high capital requirements. They're not something that stop competition. They stop certain competitors. A boxer's big fists sure stops me from entering the ring, but that's not a diminution of the level of competition in boxing. The fact that there are only a handful of people who can compete for the heavyweight championship, and most of us are precluded from the fact that by the fact that we'd be taking our lives in our hands not being really good boxers. Well, that's the outcome of competition. That's not a barrier to competition. If you make it possible for the less capable to succeed in a field, then what you have to do is make it possible for people to be in the field at a much higher level of costs and prices. That would be working diametrically against competition. Now, let me attempt to define the meaning of the political concept of monopoly more closely. I think the way to understand it is as a market. A monopoly is a market or part of a market. It could also be part of a market segment, that is reserved to the exclusive possession. There's something reserved to the exclusive possession of one or more sellers. It might even be more than one. It could be many sellers, but it's reserved to the exclusive possession of one or more sellers by means of the initiation of physical force, by or with the sanction of the government. A monopoly is a market reserved to the exclusive possession of one or more sellers, a market or part of a market, reserved to the exclusive possession of one or more sellers by means of the initiation of physical force by the government or with the sanction of the government. So if there are private individuals initiating force and the government turns its back, that's the sanction of the government. And this, incidentally, was the original concept of monopoly when the concept first came into use back in the 17th century. What monopoly was understood as was an exclusive grant of government privilege, an exclusive grant of government privilege. And leading examples of the time were an exclusive royal grant to the British East India Company to carry on the trade between Britain and the East Indies. Only this one company was legally allowed to conduct such trade. You're all aware that King Charles I was beheaded, and a factor leading up to his beheading was his granting of more and more royal monopolies. He increasingly made the provision of various trades and occupations the subject of exclusive government privileges, which increased prices and costs to people, and was one of the things that made him extremely unpopular. Now let me turn to some leading examples of monopoly according to the political concept. One fairly obvious example, I think, would be exclusive government franchises. So if the government says, or has said up to a certain time, that in a given part of the state of California, only San Diego Gas and Electric shall be able to sell electric power or provide natural gas, and no one else shall be able to do so within their defined territory, and in some other defined territory, only Pacific Gas and Electric shall be allowed to do so, or whatever. Such things would be an instance of monopoly. The government would be saying, in this area, only these companies are legally allowed to provide the product or service. Similar situations exist if there is an exclusive government franchisee operating a municipal bus line, or a telephone company, or a cable television company. Anytime you have the government saying, in this particular territory, only company X is allowed to provide this product or service, well, that, I think, is clearly an instance of monopoly according to the political concept. Now, there are other less obvious cases of monopoly, but which still fit the definition of reserving a market or part of a market to the exclusive possession of one or more sellers by means of the initiation of force. And the next leading example would be licensing laws. Licensing laws say that the only people who are legally allowed to pursue an occupation or profession are those who possess the government's license. And so the field, the pursuit of that field is limited to the license holders. All others are forcibly excluded from the field. They are simply not allowed to provide the good or service. And this applies not only to things like medicine and dentistry and law, but even down to the level of barbers and beauticians, and pharmacists and opticians, and many, many other occupations. Now notice, in the licensing case, what's particularly interesting about it is that you have a monopoly in such an instance, even though there may be thousands of individual producers, individual sellers. I don't know how many physicians we have in California. I'm sure it's quite a few thousand. But from the perspective of the political concept of monopoly, these many thousands would have between them a monopoly on the practice of medicine. All others are forcibly excluded from this area of economic activity. A protective tariff would qualify as monopoly legislation from this point of view. To whom does a protective tariff reserve the market of a country? To whom does a protective tariff reserve the market of a country? To the domestic producers. And that's its purpose. A protective tariff seeks to give a monopoly of the market, or at least a larger part of the market, to domestic producers by imposing a penalty on foreign suppliers. The foreign suppliers have to pay the tariff, and that comes out of their profits, or they have no profits, and so they can't compete. Now notice, when you have a tariff, the domestic market is reserved, to the exclusive possession of the domestic producers, or is so to a greater degree. Maybe there is some part of the domestic market that might still be served by foreign suppliers, but if the protective tariff meets its objective at all, there it's going to be served to a lesser extent by foreign suppliers. And so the part of the market that would have been served by foreign suppliers but cannot be because of the tariff, that part is reserved to the domestic producers. And it's reserved by an initiation of force. How does the initiation of force come in here? They have to pay the tariff under penalty of law, and if you owe money on the tariff, what will happen? What happens anytime you owe money? The government thinks you owe them money. What happens if you're not paying it? Something, there'll be force involved. Your property might be seized from you. You might be physically seized and end up behind bars. And if you resist, you could end up on a slab somewhere. So it's reserved by the threat of force. Now, in a tariff, with a tariff monopoly, it's possible you might have hundreds or thousands of domestic producers. If there's a protective tariff on wheat in France, that's attempting to reserve the French wheat market to the exclusive possession of French farmers. Well, the French market is monopolized against foreign suppliers. To the extent that you have a protective tariff in France, that is monopolizing the French wheat market in favor of the domestic French producers, even though there might be many thousands of such growers. Now, normally, when you have thousands of producers of something, people aren't going to think of that as monopoly. What concept would be more frequently applied? If you were to pick up a conventional mainstream textbook and you read that there's an industry with many thousands of producers, each one of whom produces far less than 1% of the total output, how would such an industry be categorized?
Not as a monopoly.
Not as monopoly. It would be held to be pure and perfect competition. Pure competition.
Okay.
But in reality, if you have these thousands protected by a protective tariff, and many of whom would be put out of business by free importation, that's a monopolistic privilege for that market. The market is being reserved to their exclusive possession, and others are being forcibly excluded. That's monopoly. Now, yet another example of monopoly, which according to the political concept, which you would rarely find discussed under this head, is minimum wage and pro-union legislation. In what sense does such legislation reserve markets to the exclusive possession of some and exclude others?
If those wages are uncompetitive,
it's excluding whom?
You would be excluding whoever's subject to the minimum wage law.
You'd be excluding those who can't be employed. See, just think of the law of demand. What does the law of demand tell us about the relationship between a price or wage on the one side and quantity demanded on the other? Connected in what way?
They move in the opposite direction.
They move in opposite directions. The higher the price or wage, the smaller the quantity demanded. In a free market, the price and wage would go to the point where the quantity demanded would be equalized with the supply that the sellers wish to sell. Now, when you have minimum wage legislation and the unions establishing their minimum wages at a higher scale for skilled and semi-skilled labor, what are you doing to the quantity of labor demanded compared to the number able and willing to work in those lines? You're reducing the quantity demanded below the supply available. The market is being reserved to the exclusive possession of the lesser number for whom there are jobs available at the higher wages. The competition of those who, for whom the demand is insufficient at the higher wages, their competition is forcibly precluded. They are forcibly excluded. Why forcibly? Where's the force behind the minimum wage and pro-union legislation?
Government.
Pardon me?
Government.
Yeah, in what way? Pardon me?
If you don't pay it, then they'll sanction
it. Yeah, you're in violation of the law if you're not paying it. The Attorney General of New York State just a few days ago, or last week or so, brought action against a bunch of restaurants in New York City. They were hiring a valet service, and the valet service provided the workers and was taking a cut of the minimum wage being paid. These guys made up for this by more in tips, but that was not considered. And that was in violation of the law, and the Attorney General was threatening major suits against these restaurants, so they had to immediately give in. But anyone who would be paying less than the minimum wage, or if you have a union contract less than the union scale, you're going to be faced with some kind of act of force. And what is it that makes you agree to the union scale in the first place? Why doesn't an employer say, when confronted with a union organizing attempt, say, I'm just not interested, I will hire non-union workers? After the union has compelled an organizing election and the union has won the election. So a majority of the present employees say they want a union. Why doesn't the employer say, well, I'm just going to see if I can get new employees?
Or you get lost.
Pardon me?
Shut down by the union strike.
Well, he couldn't simply say, I'm going
to
find other workers. He'd be held in violation, he'd be held guilty of an unfair labor practice, and the National Labor Relations Board would take action against him. He must deal with the union after it's won a bargaining election, and he must allow the union to hold a bargaining election. He can't say, this is my property, I don't want union organizers coming on it. That's my property, you're trespassing. Well, that's not observed. You're compelled to accept them and let them have their election, and then if they win it, you're compelled to bargain with them under penalty of law. you have heavy fines, your operation could be closed down. I mean, even the very threat of government action, you might have been reading in the last few days about some of the major insurance companies, Marsh and McLennan. They fired their chief executive. If you read the stories, I think the company was terrified. They were concerned that the Attorney General of New York might bring a criminal indictment against the company and cause it to evaporate like Arthur Andersen. And so immediately they do whatever the government wants. There was a story, some insurance company, AIG, I'm not quite sure what that stands for, American, is that American International Group, is it? I think it was them. They were rumored to be offering money to people to write articles or speak out on their behalf. And that was considered a kind of a quasi-criminal action. And they immediately denied having any connection with it. And we have a situation where pretty wealthy major firms and individuals are very, very frightened of the government. And these are people with a lot of high-priced lawyers. And if they can be that frightened, imagine the situation of an average person if some government agency decides that he's a target. Yes, Mr. Feldman.
It kind of almost seems like bribery. Like Computer Associates was under investigation in New York, and they settled with the government by paying these huge fines so that they wouldn't continue, the government wouldn't continue to look into their files and continue to harass them, so to speak. So yeah. Just to make them go away, they, you know, they fired their CEO and paid off these great big fines. It almost seems like kind of.
It almost seems like what?
I'll just pay you all this money so you can go away.
Well, I think the concept is close, but I wouldn't call it a bribe. I would call it extortion.
Extortion, right.
Yeah. You're not paying money for you to achieve some positive thing you want to achieve, but you're paying it out of fear.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think that certainly goes on, and the companies have, there really is, as I see it, there's not very much solid legal due process. If before a company is convicted, it has to worry about being wiped out because of an indictment. That's equivalent to you're indicted and then you're sent to jail or executed before you've had a trial. So this is really not a very healthy state. Now, yet another example of monopoly on the political concept would be government-owned or government-subsidized enterprises. All government-owned enterprises are government-subsidized. Now, when you have government subsidization, that permits those who are getting the subsidies to sell at prices that are artificially low, even to sell their, to give their services away for free, which makes it extremely difficult for private competitors to compete. Sometimes the private competitors are flat out prohibited from competing. The U.S. Postal Service, for example, someone mentioned earlier about FedEx and first class mail. The U.S. Postal Service is the sole provider of first class mail because most of the key roads of the country are declared to be post roads, and you're not illegally allowed to deliver first-class mail over post roads other than the post office. Other parties other than the post office are not allowed to deliver first-class mail over the post roads. So that's a flat-out prohibition. Now, it's not necessary that the government flatly prohibit competition, although they do that often enough. The mere fact of having substantial subsidies is sufficient to prevent competition or to minimize it. Just think, the public education system provides its services at zero cost to the students and their parents. what do you have to do to compete with that? If you want to provide private education, how would you like to be in any line of business where you have a government subsidized competitor who gives his product away for nothing? What does that do to your problems of competing? You have a huge handicap. In order to have customers, they have to value the improvement in what you're offering. They have to consider the better quality of what you're offering worth the full price. You see, if you have a free market, the normal condition is people simply have to value a product above the price being asked. If I value a new car above the price, okay, I buy the car. But suppose the government were giving some kind of car away for nothing. Every 5 years, every citizen would get some car for free. Well, what would be required to induce me to buy a new privately produced car? I would only do it if I valued the difference in quality of the privately produced car as greater than the whole price. I'd have to be regarding the premium in quality, not the totality of the car, but just its superiority over the government's car. That would have to justify my payment of the whole price. Well, that's a much, much higher hurdle. Yes, Mr.
Is it fair to say farming industry is monopolistic?
The which?
The farming industry.
The agriculture. Okay, that's a very good question. Why would you suspect it was?
Because it's government subsidized.
Well, it's government subsidized, that's true, but the subsidy arrangement is for the purpose of raising the price. We don't have some farmers who are getting subsidies competing with other, well, at least not within the United States, competing with other farmers in the same product who don't get subsidies. The subsidies are serving to diminish the overall supply available for the market. Where there is an element of monopolization, I think you're right in your overall observation, the subsidies do serve to raise the prices of agricultural products. But also, in order to limit the government's expenditure on the subsidies, what further measures does the government introduce? Like, do they simply say, if we did nothing, the price of wheat perhaps would be $3 a bushel. We want it to be $5 a bushel. Therefore, you guys, you go out, you plant all the wheat you want from fence to fence, bring in whatever new land you want to, grow wheat on it, and we'll buy as much as it takes to keep the price at $5.
No, they also limit the production.
They limit the production. They organize the producers into a virtual cartel. They introduce overall limitations on production. They require that in alternate years, a certain amount of acreage remain idle. In some cases, in order to grow a certain crop, you need a government license. So they're deliberately restricting the overall output. They're not allowing people to produce in order as part of their means of keeping the price high. So certainly from that point of view, it qualifies as monopoly. And maybe you can make a case through subsidies more directly too, but I'm not sure. Now, the last point might strike you as paradoxical, but actually we've had some discussion of it at the very outset. The antitrust laws as an instance of pro-monopoly legislation from the perspective of the political concept of monopoly. We already saw this in the example of Oracle wanting to acquire PeopleSoft and the government not letting it. Well, just think, what do the antitrust laws seek to accomplish? What are they attempting to do? Well, that's from their perspective. They want to maintain competition. But what do they mean by maintaining competition?
They don't want, like, one company to take over the entire market and down the
road. They don't want one company to take, it's not, certainly they say they don't want one company to be the sole producer of an industry. But if Oracle had taken over PeopleSoft, would they have been the sole producer? I really don't think so. Is it the case that they only prohibit mergers and acquisitions when the firm is about to be the sole supplier, or just a significantly larger supplier? I think the latter. So what the antitrust laws are doing in those cases, and also in the cases in which they would stop a firm from becoming the sole supplier, is they are keeping out of the market, or part of the market, someone who otherwise could be there. They are saying, okay, here you are, you could be in this market if we didn't stand in your way. You have the necessary capital, you have the technological knowledge, you have the organization, whatever else it may take, and what is it that's stopping the firm from being in that part of the market? The government. And that, of course, means the use and initiation of physical force. Now, let's look at a few points that follow from this discussion. This is point six. Four points to remember about monopoly according to the political concept. It can be many protected against one or a few. You see, normally we're always thinking of monopoly as one firm. The conventional approach is a monopoly exists when there is one firm that is the sole supplier. But from the perspective of the political concept of monopoly, you could have a monopoly when there are thousands of firms, provided that what is enabling them to remain is the initiation of force, provided that the market is reserved to them by the initiation of force. You could have a monopoly, in fact, in which everyone is allowed to be in an industry with the exception of one party who otherwise would be there, or would be there to a greater extent. Suppose back in the early days of the automobile industry, the government had said, we allow anyone to enter the automobile industry who may wish to do so, with one leading exception, and that's Henry Ford. Well, from the perspective of the political concept of monopoly, such legislation would be monopoly legislation. You'd have a market reserved to the exclusive possession of everyone, with the significant exception of Ford. We came very close to something, maybe we already actually have it to some degree, just a very few years ago in the Microsoft case. The court was considering whether they should break Microsoft up and require that there be two separate distinct companies, one just producing the Windows operating system and the other producing various applications like Word and Excel, etc. Now, suppose that had been the decision handed down. So Gates would have had to be with the one or the other. Well, what would be the arrangement if we said, here we are, the writing of computer software is legally free to everyone, with the exception of Gates, who is legally precluded from entering into either the operating system portion or the application system portion. I would say that industry would have been monopolized against Gates. It would have been reserved to the exclusive possession of everyone in the society with that major exception. And that, since he is someone who is able to do something substantial, that would be quite significant. Now, you have a substantial number of cases where you have monopoly legislation that is monopolizing the market in favor of many against a comparative few, and sometimes against even just one. In many European countries, I don't know if this is still the case, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is, at least in some, there were laws designed to hamper the competition of chain stores and department stores. I don't know if it's still true in France. They have separate butchers for pork and beef. Does anyone know if that's still the case? One is a charcuterie, that's the pork butcher. I forget what they call the beef butcher. They have this fine subdivision, and they have many small shopkeepers and merchants, and a large segment of the French electorate wants to keep it that way. And so to do that, over the years, they've had legislation restricting the growth of chain stores and department stores. Now, suppose we start off, we have X thousand small pork butchers and beef butchers, whatever, and that's the initial state of affairs. But we have economic development, and part of economic development is replacing much of that with a smaller number of larger chain stores, chain supermarkets, and department stores and the like. So we end up with, instead of X thousand, we have single digit X. Now, from the perspective of the political concept of monopoly, the protective legislation for the small shopkeepers, that would be monopoly legislation. That's legislation reserving the market to the exclusive possession of those suppliers and forcibly excluding the chain stores and department stores. In New York City, they have taxicab licensing. Since 1938, the number of licenses to cruise the streets for hire has been essentially frozen in the neighborhood of 12,000. You know, to operate a cab in New York, you need not only the cab and knowledge of how to drive the cab, you also need this little item called a medallion, which is affixed to the hood of the cab. And back in 1938, the city council issued about 11,800 something of these medallions. And then a few years ago, I think they issued a few hundred more. So maybe it's a little over 12,000 now. And in order legally to operate a cab cruising the streets for hire, you must have one of these medallions. Does anyone know the current market value of one of these medallions? Yeah, it's in excess of $200,000, I think even $250,000. And why do you think people are willing to pay that much for one of these precious medallions?
Isn't an exclusive right to
try the
taxi cab?
Well, limited.
Pardon me?
It's a limited availability.
Well, it's true, there are only a limited number of medallions, but there's a limited number of copies of many things that don't command much of a price. The current supply of my book is much below the New York City taxicab medallions, but my book sells for much less than $250,000.
Pardon me? The potential profit on driving a taxicab is much greater.
Yeah, there's a premium income if you're in a position to drive a cab for hire. There's extra money to be taken in each year, and the present discounted value of the extra money extending over the life of the medallion amounts to about $250,000. So if the rate of discount were 10%, which maybe it is, if the rate of discount is 10%, that would imply that if for every year going out into perpetuity, you could expect to earn an extra $25,000 a year, well, that would be worth $250,000 today. Now, the limitation of the medallions is what serves to contribute to that income. Suppose you didn't need a medallion. Suppose we start off today. By driving a cab, you can make $25,000 extra income over and above what you could earn by working in some other line and using the same capital in some other line. So you have a $25,000 premium in income just by driving a cab. And what do you think the effect would be in a free market where you didn't have these medallions? Pardon me? Yes?
Everybody would enter the market until that profit would drop down. Until you pull up the profit of a different market.
Yeah, there'd be additional taxi cabs available, and the fares would come down. And even if the fares were prohibited from coming down, the extent to which cabs were operating in idleness would reduce the average annual income. One way or another, the premium in income would be eliminated. And if the government were not involved in controlling the rates, the cab fares would drop too. Now, If this happened, if we had a free market in taxi cabs, there would be lower fares and lower revenue per cab. What would you have to do to try to reestablish some measure of profitability in the face of lower cab fares and lower revenue per cab?
Deliver the best quality.
Pardon me?
Reduce your costs and deliver high quality.
Okay, you'd have to certainly reduce your costs and, to the extent possible, improve the quality. Now, what sort of thing do you think would be required to reduce costs? The way things stand today, of the 12,000 or so medallions, a very large proportion, I think possibly on the order of 8,000, are held by independent owner-operators. So you have, in essence, one man, one cab, and that accounts for 8,000 of the medallions. Now, if the fares were lower and the income to be earned in operating a cab were lower, and the need were created to cut costs, I think that would favor large fleet operation. Because a fleet can achieve lower unit costs. They can have the cabs out on the streets three shifts a day. They have on-the-spot mechanics available. They have a quick turnaround time in repairing cabs. So I think free competition would favor large cab companies, and the outcome would probably be that instead of 8,000 plus cab firms, we might end up with a handful. But that would be the result of free competition, just like a small number of large supermarkets instead of a small number of small merchants. And so I would say, here's an example of monopoly legislation that's protecting the less efficient many against the competition of the more efficient few. Yes, Mr. Underwood.
What is the government's rationale for limiting the number of cabs? I mean, is it just a...
What is their rationale for limiting the number of cabs? Well, I guess if you asked many of them, they'd say if we had more cabs, then we'd have more congestion on the streets. But then, by the same token, if there were more cabs that were more affordable and more readily available, there would be fewer people feeling the need to use their own cars. So I would say it's doubtful that you'd have more congestion. You might well have less. But now they also have a rationale. They see now the people who paid a fortune for their medallions, you'd have a major problem in eliminating the system. Because what would you do with these people? You'd have to do something to compensate them. So this is a serious consequence of having licenses, and the licenses acquiring a value. It creates a major obstacle in the way of ever getting rid of the system. Yes, Mr. Felton?
Is New York, to your knowledge, the only place where the value type system operates in major cities?
I think it's fairly common. Yeah, I think, I would think, I'm not certain of this, but I assume it exists in Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, all of the major cities. Okay, well, just a little more. Monopoly is not necessarily profitable. It is in certain cases. If you have an exclusive government franchise and there were no control on the rates, so if you're in a situation where you are the only party allowed to provide some good or service, if that good or service is in demand, you could simply charge whatever the market would bear, and you wouldn't have to worry about anyone ever being a competitive threat. So in that kind of case, the monopoly would be exceptionally profitable. But there are many other instances of monopoly where it's not particularly profitable, such as tariff monopoly, where you have thousands of domestic producers. There's no need that any of them are particularly profitable, but it's still a monopoly. It's a monopoly protecting high-cost producers, enabling high-cost producers to stay in business. And similarly with government subsidies, can enable high-cost producers to remain in business who are incurring huge losses. That's the state of the post office, and I think probably you could argue public education, too. Yes, Mr. Severin?
Just had a question kicking around my head. I hope it comes out right. But
okay.
My thought is, you know, we have an economy we're trying to protect.
Yeah.
And if we have, what are the long-term or short-term ramifications of just getting rid of any tariffs from as far as foreign competition, allowing them to come in at any price, mm-hmm. and what is the potential short-term effect of labor here if we did that?
I would say it would bring about a rise in real wage rates in the United States. Because with comparative advantage, there are many things that we would be able to import more cheaply than we produce them at home. And at the same time, there would be other things that we'd produce in greater volume for export.
There might be a big shift.
Maybe a shift,
yeah. In the short run, companies may go out of business that wouldn't be able to compete, but then that would shift to something else?
Yeah, there'd be some companies that would go out of business. I mean, just think, with economic progress, this is always the case. Think of the number of Teamster companies that went out of business, who had horse-drawn wagons and mule wagons and so forth through the competition of the railroads. Think of the impact on the railroads of the automobile and trucks and so forth. And so we always have things changing. Agriculture has shrunk very greatly relative to the rest of the economy. Other parts have grown. So the loss of certain types of businesses which are outmoded, that doesn't mean that the economy is losing. Far from it. People will be employed in other lines, and the effect will be an increase in overall output and a rise in the standard of living.
There's been this big concern about manufacturing leaving. Now we've become a service economy. That's leading to, like, some people fail to imagine what's left for us to create.
The loss of services, I think, is relatively minor overall. Manufacturing has been lost, I think, to an unnecessarily large extent. We could easily regain some substantial manufacturing if we eliminated the government intervention involved. I don't know if we had this discussion or not, stop me if we did, but take such things as the automobile industry. For many years, people have complained that American cars are of lower quality than the imports. And I'm sure that there's a large measure of truth to that. And it's common for people to talk about Monday morning cars and maybe Friday afternoon cars. What does that phenomenon refer to?
Cars manufactured on Monday tend to be of lesser quality than if any cars manufactured on Friday afternoon, because people have that weekend mindset, ready to go on the weekend, ready to party. They don't put as much quality into the cars.
All right, and the Monday morning phenomenon is supposedly the result of not everyone showing up because they haven't fully recovered from their weekend partying, or if they do show up, they're not in too great condition to really work. Now, the automobile companies, the people running the automobile companies are far from stupid, so they know that this is a problem. Why don't they simply say everybody shows up Monday morning able and ready to work? If you don't show up, don't bother showing up at all. We'll just replace you. Why can't they do that? That isn't all that complicated.
The union.
Yeah, they would have a major strike on their hands if they had some cases like this. So they let it ride. Well, why do they put up with the union? Why do they have to worry about the strike? They're locked in with the National Labor Relations Board. Suppose those laws were simply abolished, and here we are, everyone is complaining. We have a high unemployment rate, there's unemployment in the auto industry, the steel industry. There are a lot of people around either who are unemployed or are doing lesser jobs that could do the jobs of the auto workers and people in other industries. Why aren't they given the jobs? Well, they could be if we didn't have the intervention. And then what do you think the effect would be if we had an improvement in the quality of American automobiles, and also if the auto firms didn't have to deal with the auto union, the auto workers union, what do you think would happen to the efficiency of their methods of production?
Increase.
I think they would have a substantial increase. That would cut their costs. They would be an awful lot more competitive. And the same story, I think, would be repeated in the steel industry. There's no reason that the United States has had to lose this much of a chunk of its manufacturing. This is the result of government intervention. Yes?
Going back to the auto example, now, how come the cars produced by Toyota are higher quality? They are also produced in the U.S.
Yes, I know, but are the Toyota plants union plants?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Are they, in fact? I'm not sure that they are. Yes, Mr. Say.
Wasn't it during the Reagan administration that he at one point fired a whole bunch of those airline workers or something like that?
Yeah, the air traffic controllers.
Were those workers unionized?
Yes, that was a union. It was called the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, PATCO.
And how is the, how come such an, execution of...
Okay, because they were government employees, and there was legislation on the books limiting the right to strike of government employees. And they violated the limit. They were given warning that the law requires that they return to work. And then after they failed to do so, that union was decertified. It lost its official government recognition as a legitimate bargaining agent. So that's how that happened. Okay, so we can have cases where monopolies are by no means necessarily profitable. The monopoly element simply serves to protect high-cost producers. Now, a further point that I think needs to be made is in connection with patents and copyrights. A patent or copyright gives you an exclusive legal right to produce something. But I do not think that they are basically monopolies. That proposition is somewhat dubious today in the case of copyrights, because the United States now has it changed the copyright law just a few years ago. A copyright today expires only 95 years after the death of the author. It was, until not many years ago, 50 years after the death of the author. And that had itself been raised not too many years before from a limited term, two terms of a copyright, each of 28 years. The way the copyright read until possibly sometime in the 80s, I'm not quite sure just what year the change was made, but it used to be that you could get a copyright for 28 years and then renew it for another 28, and that would be the end of it. So if you copyrighted something when you were 20 years old and you lived to be 77, you'd spend that part of your life after your copyright had expired. And then that was changed to 50 years after the death of the author or creator. But then, as we started to approach the 50-year limit on characters like Mickey Mouse and, I guess, Donald Duck, one of the great creative contributions of Michael Eisner was to work to get the copyright law extended. He was unable to encourage the development of new cartoon characters of comparable value, but what he could do was win the votes of enough congressmen to change the law. And it would have been not all that serious if all that had been involved was Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck and the Disney characters, but a massive slew of works that otherwise would now be in the public domain are still under copyright as the result of this. There was an article I was just reading in today's New York Times. The copyright in Australia still expires 63 years after the death of the author. And so there's this website, Project Gutenberg, that you may have heard of, They have an Australian branch, and it put on its website Gone with the Wind, the copyright on which has expired according to Australian law. But they apparently were threatened with some legal action by American lawyers, so they took it off their website. But maybe it'll go back, I don't know. But in any case, if we had copyrights of a reasonable duration and patents of a reasonable duration, I think the patent system probably still is of a reasonable duration. You may know this better than I. I believe the term of a patent is 17 years, and then you can renew it for another 17 years. Is that correct?
It was 20 years.
Pardon me?
Except in pharmaceuticals.
What is it in pharmaceuticals?
You can't renew it. Unless you change the molecule.
You can't renew it in pharmaceuticals unless you have some molecular change. Okay, so that would mean the patent term in pharmaceuticals is just 17 years, if that's correct. Okay, well now, the reason that I would not call patents and copyrights of a reasonable term, such as 17 or even 34 years on patents, or 56 years on copyrights, the reason I would not call them monopoly legislation is that what they are doing is simply giving legal recognition to the rights of the creator. Someone has had to create the book or song or whatever. Someone has had to make the invention. And I would say a person who has done this has an implicit property right in his creation. Just as someone who has cleared a piece of land, who's mixed his labor with the land, he acquires a right to the land. And someone who is the creator of some new product or method of production, or book or song, as its creator, he has a property right, which the patent and copyright legislation are merely giving legal recognition to. Now, further, the economic effect of a patent and copyright system of a reasonable term is that it leads to the increase in the supply of new products and new methods by making their invention and creation worthwhile. Suppose we didn't have any patent or copyright legislation. And now, here's a firm that is developing a new product. Let's say it cost them $100 million or more to develop. Now they've got it. They have a model on the market. Someone spends $50 or $100 to buy this model, takes it apart, figures out how to make it, and then is off making it himself without having had to incur any substantial development costs. Well, and so the party who's made the development, he's not in a position ever to recoup that expense. Well, what do you think the effect would be the next time someone was thinking of developing some expensive product? It wouldn't happen. It wouldn't happen. If you take away the patent and copyright protection, you can have one temporary burst of cheaper products. You get the benefit of the things that are already there, that have been invented, that have been created. But the flow of new products that have not yet appeared, that would be radically cut. And I think this point has application to the current controversy over importing drugs from Canada. Not that I'm against the ability of people to import, but in Canada and many other countries, you have government price control on drugs. See, the drugs in question are patented. It costs an awful lot of money to develop a new drug. A lot more than it needs to cost, because it takes the FDA so long before they're prepared to approve something. But it may cost hundreds of millions of dollars to develop new drugs. Do you know much about that industry?
They say it takes $700 million, but you know.
Okay. Well, I'm sure it's quite substantial. Now, maybe the manufacturing cost of a pill is very insignificant after you've spent however many hundreds of millions to produce it. So Nexium, I think, is charging about $5 a pill in the open market. I don't know what it costs them to produce one of those tablets. But if You made them charge a price that just covered their manufacturing costs plus a rate of profit on their manufacturing capital. You're not going to have many more Nexium. So the idea of the patent system is you let those who are introducing new pharmaceuticals, new products of any kind, they can make a premium profit for a limited time. They have the exclusive possession of the field based on a foundation that they've created the thing. It's their creation, their property. The logic would be when the government is stopping people from infringing a patent or copyright, a legitimate patent or copyright, its use of force is not an initiated use. It's protecting a pre-existing right in the same way that if someone is coming onto a farmer's land against the will of the farmer, hopefully the sheriff will show up and dispossess the trespassers. That's not an initiation of force. That's a use of force in defense, not initiation. And if you have a proper patent or copyright and the government is protecting your right, it's not initiating force against the infringers. It's using force in defense because they have initiated the force. They're acting in violation of your property rights in your creation. Now, the Canadian government and many other governments don't want to recognize any of these short-term exclusive property rights in pharmaceuticals. They want the price to be substantially lower. It pays the drug companies to go on producing and supplying them because the price, though controlled, is still above their manufacturing costs and still provides some significant positive profit margin on their manufacturing costs. But it's not helping them recover their research and development costs. The only place they're able to recover the research and development costs and make a premium profit on the process is in the American market. Now, I would think the proper solution would be the Canadian government and other governments outside should not be imposing price controls on pharmaceuticals. Let the pills sell for what the market will bear in those countries, and we should be able to have free importation from everywhere. But we have this system where they're attempting to destroy the profitability of new products in much of the rest of the world. Yeah, Mr. Trex.
Would you go so far as to say that the patents and copyrights limited to a certain duration actually encourages
Yes, yes. Patents and copyrights do, if they're limited to a certain reasonable term, they do encourage competition because they're encouraging the development of new products, new methods of production, which will then compete with the established methods. And if we couldn't do this, then we wouldn't have the competition of the new products. Now, incidentally, before I forget, there's an excellent essay on the subject of patents and copyrights that I would like to recommend to you all, which I'm sure I refer to in footnotes. And this is an essay, I think, whose title is Patents and Copyrights. It's by Ayn Rand, and it appears in a paperback book that's very widely available and that contains many other excellent essays. And the book is Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. And I think she develops a very good foundation for the existence of patents and copyrights, and also the basis for determining their limit. And as I put it here, patents and copyrights in the long run reduce costs and prices by virtue of promoting economic progress. That's the longer run effect. At some point, the patent comes off, the copyright comes off, and then the price is governed by its current cost of production, the item's current cost of production. Now, finally, on the political concept, all monopoly in the last analysis is based on government intervention, which serves to restrict the freedom of entry and freedom of competition. Stopping the entry of those who could be there, stopping the competition of those who could compete, and doing so by means of the initiation of physical force. And finally, the significance of monopoly on the political concept. It reduces the range of choice. It keeps sellers out of the market who otherwise could be in the market. It protects higher cost, less efficient producers. It protects lower quality products against higher quality products because of restricting the freedom of entry and competition of sellers and potential sellers. Okay, let's turn now to the better known, much more frequently discussed economic concept of monopoly. And the meaning of this is simply a single seller of a given good in a given territory. If there's a single seller of a given good in a given territory, most people would call that monopoly. Now, I'll just say, try to make a connection back to the political concept. The political concept also recognizes cases in which the single seller of a good is a monopolist. It would say the British East India Company represented a monopoly. It was the single provider of shipping between Britain and the East Indies. But what was the essential feature that made it a monopoly? Yeah, its position rested on the power of the government. Now, we could have other instances where there is, again, only one supplier. For example, Alcoa, before World War II, was the sole producer of aluminum ingot in the United States. But its position did not rest on any kind of initiation of force by the government. What it did was it constantly built new capacity, it constantly improved its product, reduced its cost of production, and expanded to meet a growing demand. So it was the sole provider by virtue of superiority of its product and its price. According to the political concept of monopoly, even though there's only one company in this instance, that's not a monopoly. Everyone else is legally free to enter. No one is forcibly excluded. The market is not reserved to Alcoa's exclusive possession. It happens to be in Alcoa's exclusive possession because Alcoa is far and away the best producer. So the critical thing is to contrast the two concepts, not the number of producers, but the element of forcible exclusion, forcible exclusiveness, which could be with just one company or thousands. The essential of monopoly on the political concept is a market reserved to the exclusive possession of one or many. It's the exclusive possession based on the government's initiation of force. But if you have one firm and there's no initiation of force by the government, that's not a monopoly according to the political concept. But it is according to the economic concept. Now, working with the economic concept, this one concept can be interpreted in different ways, such as to embrace hardly anything or very few things, which was the case up until the 1930s, or almost everything, which is the case now and since the 1930s. Let me illustrate how this can come about. It'll depend on how broadly or narrowly we define a given good. See, here we are, we have this definition, a single seller of a given good in a given territory. Well, what do we mean by a given good in any particular case? Suppose we talked of a given good and we said the given good was beverages. Well, what does beverages include?
Many different.
Good. It includes water, milk, soft drinks, alcoholic beverages, anything, fruit juices, anything that people can drink. Well, that's a very, very wide definition of a good. That's an enormously wide definition. Now, we can make the definition of a good narrower. We can say soft drink beverages, That's a much, much narrower category. We can narrow it still further. Carbonated soft drink beverages. Still narrower. Cola carbonated soft drink beverages. And then finally, Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola. Now, when you get down to Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola, then it appears that these firms are monopolists. In what sense would they be monopolists according to the economic concept of monopoly? Pardon me?
The only ones that produce Coca-Cola.
Yeah, the only producer of Coca-Cola is the Coca-Cola company, and the only producer of Pepsi-Cola is the Pepsi-Cola company. So from that point of view, if you define things narrowly enough, practically everything can appear as a monopoly. For example, how many pizza parlors are Joe's Pizza Parlor at 9th and Main? Well, almost certainly just one. So from this point of view, on the economic definition of monopoly, it's possible that practically everything could appear as a monopoly. To whatever extent there was anything unique about it, to whatever extent there's anything unique about something, it can be made to appear as a monopoly. Now, this, you might say, goes against common sense, and I suppose to some extent it may. People did not think this way very frequently prior to the 1930s. Up until the 1930s, even though the political concept of monopoly had been more or less lost, people were still thinking that monopoly was exceptional, that they thought the normal condition was free competition. That's what characterized 95% of the economy, perhaps. The instances of monopoly were considered to be few and far between. Examples of monopoly were thought to be limited to cases where perhaps you had one railway between two cities. People would say, okay, that's a monopoly. Or you have one gas company. That's a monopoly. Or you have a small village and there's only one general store. That's a monopoly. But everything else, the steel industry, the coal industry, practically everything, that would be considered free competition, at least up till the end of the 1920s. Then, in the 1930s, two new concepts were developed in economic theory, which have had the effect of spreading the taint of monopoly pretty much throughout the economic system. And these two concepts were monopolistic competition and oligopoly. Monopolistic competition and oligopoly. If you pick up a typical textbook, you might read a definition of monopolistic competition as cases in which there are a large number of relatively small sellers producing or selling slightly differentiated products. So Joe's Pizza Parlor versus Giuseppe's Pizza Parlor, if there's some difference, Joe is friendlier than Giuseppe or whatever, or his pizza is better seasoned, that would be a case of monopolistic competition. Or Frank's Barbershop versus Al's Barbershop. There's this other concept, oligopoly, which is supposed to refer to situations in which we have the physically the same product, the same identical product, sold by only a small number of sellers. Oligopoly means few. Oli, it's the same root as oligarch. Oligopoly, few, few sellers. Monopoly is one seller. Oligopoly is few sellers. And where there are just few sellers, that too is supposed to represent something that will have the pretty much the same outcome, allegedly, as where there is one seller, for reasons we will probably not get to until next week. Now, in practice, these two concepts, monopolistic competition and oligopoly, work out to be pretty much the same, If you read textbook examples, I've read examples where Posts and Kellogg's are cited as examples of monopolistic competition, even though how many major breakfast cereal producers are there? They're two of the very largest, and so you could equally talk about that in terms of oligopoly. Similarly, Ford and General Motors there, and Toyota, their automobiles are somewhat different from one another. So you could talk about them either in terms of monopolistic competition, if you're focusing on the differences, or oligopoly, if you're focusing on the fewness of the sellers, small number of sellers. Then further, even in those cases in which you might have a large number of small sellers of slightly differentiated products across a very broad territory, like we certainly have many thousands of restaurants in the state of California, and more thousands across the whole country. But how many Cantonese Chinese restaurants do we have in the city of Irvine? How many Northern Italian restaurants do we have in Tustin? I don't think very many, and so I doubt that there's any more, certainly probably less, than the number of automobile firms we have. So from that perspective, you'd have to say that these cases of small businesses represent a kind of local oligopoly, if you're applying these concepts consistently. But in any case, between monopolistic competition and oligopoly, it is today thought that perhaps 95% of the economy is characterized by some significant element of monopoly. Let's talk on the one extreme, this pure monopoly, where there's only one seller. Then there are many, many further cases where we have unique products, Coke versus Pepsi, or Giuseppe's Pizza versus Luigi's Pizza. Or we have a small number of producers in the steel industry, the auto industry, whatever. And so today it is thought that only a very small number of cases remains as what is called pure competition, or pure and perfect competition, whose essential characteristics are the combination of a very large number of sellers of physically identical products. And it's thought that there are only a very few instances of pure and perfect competition, notably agricultural commodities. In agriculture, we have many thousands of producers of the exact same physical product, like number 10 middling cotton, or hard winter wheat, or whatever it may be. The product is physically identical, or the differences are not perceptible. And there's an enormous number of sellers. So it's thought that represents pretty much the only case of actual existing pure and perfect competition. But then, of course, if we allow for the real-world fact that the government cartelizes most of agriculture, even that doesn't remain. So the bottom line is that the way things are generally perceived today, the great overwhelming bulk of economic activity is thought to represent some significant element of monopoly, according to the economic concept. Okay, it's time, I think, to take our break, and please come back in 25 minutes. If for any reason you can't, do me the courtesy of letting me know, okay? So see you in 25 minutes.